Thank you for downloading this podcast of Melanie Tebbutt discussing psychology and the outdoor movement, recorded at the British Society of Sports History Northwest Workshop.
There's a large scholarly literature has encouraged a very familiar narrative, I think, about the development of the British outdoor movement in the interwar years. Harvey Taylor's pioneering work on the movement's history of claim on the countryside, which illustrates the deep historical roots of popular attachment to the countryside, has highlighted the diversity of the outdoor movement in the interwar years, when cheap fares and railway excursions helped to democratise relationships with the rural, as better transport systems and roads opened up areas which had previously been exclusive to the better off. Freedom, exploration, and the romance of the open road, which had long been identified with the English countryside, became key motifs of interwar tourism as visitors tramped, camped, trespassed, and claimed places which geographically would once have been far beyond their reach. This well-known story tends to neglect, however, I think, how rural engagement was nuanced in very different ways across the 1920s and the 1930s. The existing focus tends, understandably, to be on the 1930s, when the open-air recreational lobby became a national movement and the politics of popular rambling became most pronounced. Excuse me. Hiking, camping, caravans, cycling, youth hostelling all expanded in the 1930s when the Youth Hostel Association and the Ramblers Association were established and access campaigns intensified. The Kindermass trespass took place in 1932, and there's quite a nice generational difference, I think, in the two illustrations that I have there. But what I want to raise, lovely, thank you, what I want to raise today is, what about the earlier part of this interwar narrative, the immediate post-war years and the 1920s, when open-air activities were certainly expanding but had not yet achieved either the scale or cultural prominence of the 1930s? What is their place in this historical story of the outdoor movement? This quieter period has certainly attracted much less attention from us scholars, and it's really the purpose of my paper to redress this relative neglect by offering something of a speculative overview, and I emphasise the speculative aspect of this, taking an approach perhaps which is rather different from usual interpretations of the period. My paper's aim is to explore the therapeutic value and meanings of different kinds of recreational engagement with the countryside, and to ask how such activities may have helped mediate some of the psychological and emotional after effects of the First World War. The beneficial effects of certain types of environmental setting on the sick and the distressed have been perceived throughout history and across cultures. The rest cure was a treatment for neurasthenia in the late Victorian and Edwardian periods, and the value of recuperating outdoors was a recognised part of the sanatoria movement, which emphasised convalescence in hospital gardens and landscaped grounds. Since the 1980s, however, commonplace assumptions about the value of the rural in physical and mental rehabilitation have received growing academic attention in a large number of studies which have explored the positive and negative effects that particular types of landscape may have on psychological health. Studies by environmental psychologists have highlighted the role that engagement with particular kinds of physical environment can play in healing and recovery, while research has become increasingly sensitive to the links between landscape, health, and the psychological value of open space. In the early 1990s, for example, the health geographer Will Gesler introduced the conceptual device of therapeutic landscapes to explore the relationship between healing and nature and between place identity and health and well-being. This is a New Zealand postcard of this of sanatorium gardens that were developed as a spa town but were also developed around thermal springs which had a sacred place in Maori mythology. Since the 1900s, the notion of the therapeutic landscape has expanded from associations with places of pilgrimage, spas and sacred sites to encompass more domestic settings such as homes, gardens and imagined landscapes. And I think these ideas are potentially a very useful entry into exploring the emotional and psychological significance of landscape, of both landscape and outdoor activities after the First World War, particularly in relation to the personal meanings of such engagement. These, I think, have tended to be neglected in comparison with the therapeutic places established by the authorities, such as hospitals and convalescent homes, which have received considerable academic attention. Rather like that picture, one of my favourites. Researchers into the therapeutic aspects of contemporary engagement with the natural world have identified three main types. These are viewing nature as through a window or in a painting, being in proximity to nature, which can be quite incidental to some other kind of activity, such as walking or cycling to work or talking to friends in a park, and active participation and involvement with nature, such as could be gardening, but it also could be cross-country running or climbing. All of these, I think, are worth attention when examining emotional survival and resilience in the interwar years, when many people in a deeply traumatised society were still attempting to process the social and psychological implications of the war. The intention of this paper, however, is to focus on the third type, active participation, particularly in relation to outdoor activities such as climbing and walking, what John Walton has described as pedestrianism for pleasure and camping, and I'll also have one or two occasional asides to the idea of viewing nature. The second category of being in proximity to nature is not addressed here because the sources are actually very difficult. They're difficult enough for this, and they're even more difficult, I think, in some respects. Now, if you're talking about the psychological impact of the First World War, people immediately tend to think of shell shock, which had considerable cultural resonance in the 1920s. And in fact, the war's psychological impact has received much scholarly attention. But this has largely been in relation to the exploration, the medical treatment of trauma. And trauma, that shell shock is, of course, something of a catch-all term, which was first used in a medical paper by the psychologist Charles S. Myers in 1915. Shell shock, of course, described a range of symptoms, disorientation, nightmares, hallucinations, paralysis. And, of course, soldiers didn't have to have been at the front to experience these symptoms. As is well known, some were shot for malingering, some were forced back into battle, and others were hospitalised. By the end of the war, Army Medical Services had treated over 80,000 cases of shell shock, although the real number of those needing treatment was probably much higher. And I think, from my point of view, shell shock remains an important source of controversy and ambivalence throughout the 1920s, when more than 100,000 ex-servicemen were said to be suffering from its long-term effects. Actually, the treatment of shell shock was considerably marginalised in the 1920s anyway. Shell shock has become what Jay Winter has described as a metaphor for the war itself, and that's been exemplified over the past decade by a great expansion of scholarship in relation to it, starting with Peter Lees's book Shell Shock and Ben Shepherd's War of Nerves, both of which were published in 2002. However, those who feature less prominently in this story of post-war rehabilitation are the men who lived on into the post-war years, those whom Fiona Reid has described as the mentally broken men who were in one degree or another mended. Many of these suffered the consequences of periodic or even chronic emotional disturbances, which never actually reached the attention of the medical authorities, although they continued to shape how many social and emotional relationships were negotiated throughout the interwar years. Joanna Burke has argued that the emphasis on emotional breakdown and psychiatric illness has actually obscured the fact that though most men coped remarkably well with the demands made upon them during wartime, and others have argued that most men survived during the war by drawing on a range of coping strategies to help sustain their emotional resilience. These kinds of arguments do, however, rather beg the question of exactly how these men readjusted to a post-war civilian world and the kinds of readjustment strategies they employed to ease their transition to very different peacetime circumstances. The assimilation and the digestion, frequently traumatic war experiences took time, and the 1920s may in some respects be seen as a period of long convalescence, broken by the economic depression of 1929 to 1931. So the question I'm asking is that with no practical support available to them, how did these men and their families manage the transition to the post-World War and survive the repercussions of often strangely altered mental attitudes and characters? Now that's a big question, and I'm not suggesting that it's just sort of focused on an idea of landscape and the outdoor movement. I think it raises all sorts of issues about, you know, relationships within families. But for this particular purpose, as I said, I'm focusing on the outdoor movement and the and landscape. Thinking just for a moment about survival strategies on the Western Front, several scholarly works in recent years have moved emphases away from the medical treatment of shell shock to examine how ordinary soldiers developed their own survival strategies on the Western Front. That's where we link a little bit, I think, Grace. And I think they can help us to look in different ways at the meanings which were ascribed to nature and the natural world, but not only during the war, but after it. I mean, Michael Roper's The Secret Battle is particularly impressive for its use of personal narratives, such as letters, diaries and memoirs of combatants, to explore how they sustained emotional ties with home. And Roper's work gives important insights into how emotional dislocation on the Western Front was mediated by relationships with home, sustained by through parcels and correspondence with families, particularly their mothers. The powerful motif of the mother is strongly associated with wartime propaganda, but Roper skillfully evokes the personal meanings of mothering for men in trenches, not only through relationships sustained with home, but in the domesticated terms in how ways in which men often nurtured each other. Now, you might say, well, where does this fit in with what she's saying? Well, George Moss suggested that the war encouraged acute sensitivity to nature and the natural world, an identification which has been often viewed as a nostalgic trope of national identity. And I think the reason why I'm talking about Roper is that I think his approach to the importance of mothering among men in the trenches is also a prompt for us to rethink the meanings of remembered rural landscapes under wartime conditions, and to use similar personal sources, the sorts of sources that you've been using, as an entry into how these may have shaped emotional engagement as another strategy for psychological survival. As we all know, the countryside played an important part in how English national identity has been constructed over the past two centuries. And I think that's often tended to overshadow its meanings for ordinary people, especially as they began to gain access to it in greater numbers after the First World War. Now, Paul Fussell has argued, and I won't kind of rehearse that background because I'm sure that you're all very familiar with it, but Paul Fussell has argued that the war intensified the well-established cultural resonance of rural imagery and the countryside. Officers had country life sent out to them as a comforting reminder of rolling southern landscapes and communities, and pastoral motifs and rural imagery, especially located in the southern English countryside, became a common focus for an elite literature of war poetry by writers like Siegfried Sassoon, Wilfred Owen, there's a whole raft of them, many of whom had often suffered from shell shock. The universalisation of these works of high culture, however, tends to obscure the extent to which class and regional background inflected the meanings of the rural during the war. Soldiers from working class districts in northern England, for example, took copies of their Clarion Ramblers handbooks with them to the trenches, which nourished reveries, sustained a sense of community, and maybe drew them back into the everyday pleasures of familiar walks in upland settings. And I think maybe a useful exercise would be to map the other kinds of rural mementos which those who had grown up in the country kept as memories of their former lives in the trenches. Just as an aside, the evocative power of the English country garden even gave rise to soldiers attempting to recreate it in their trenches. One soldier in 1915, for example, described how his trench had within it a square garden with diagonal lattice wood paths, with quite a profusion of old-fashioned flowers, marsh marigold, mignonette, snapdragon, all flourishing right underneath the parapet. There's an ironic reversal of that. Recently, that's a historian who's been reconstructing a 60-foot-long trench in his own back garden. So the fractured nature of the natural world on the Western Front could both intensify and dislocate the meanings of space, nature and landscape in ways which Jeremy Burkhardt has suggested were hugely variable and are really deserving of a book in themselves. So I'm kind of taking quite a narrow focus inevitably. Moss suggested that heavy shelling destroyed not only men but nature, a devastation that would haunt the imagination of those forced to live in the trenches. And it's an observation which raises many questions, like I said, about how survivors actually mediated those memories after the war. Soldiers at the front, living below ground in cold and stinking trenches, inhabited a subterranean, disorientated world of what Santanu Das has described as slimescapes in his book Touch and Intimacy. Some experienced this as claustrophobia, some experienced it as agoraphobic, but all the anxieties that people experienced in relation to that sense of space around them were exacerbated on the Western Front by immobility, noise and lack of control over the physical environment. All of it was magnified by waiting for something to happen. It was that enforced passivity that was emotionally incapacitating and which gave rise to a terrifying impotence. And that's very clear, I think, in this letter from Paul Nash, which he sent to his wife in 1917. It encapsulated a sense of a toxic, unnatural environment and personal dread. No pen or drawing can convey this country. Sunset and sunrise are blasphemous. They are mockeries to man. Only the rain black out of the bruised and swollen clouds all through the bitter black of night is fit atmosphere in such a land. The rain drives in the stinking mud, becomes more evilly yellow. The shell holes fill up with green, white water. The roads and tracks are covered in inches of slime. The black dying trees ooze and sweat and the shells never cease. It is unspeakable, godless, hopeless. Now, I'm not trying to suggest that everybody experienced it in that way, but it's a kind of sense of the meanings that the landscape did have for some men in those situations. Now, David Conradson has emphasised the diverse responses to which specific environments give rise. It can be, dislike, enjoyment, ambivalence, anxiety, but it's easy to see how the extreme edges of these reactions might be intensified under war conditions, depending, of course, on where the soldier was located. Not everybody was at the Western Front. There are other kind of examples. The soldier Hugh Quigley mused in his wartime diary how the beautiful in nature, even in the bleak horror of shell holes, seemed the essence of life to me, the only thing worth seeking in the miseries of war. So I'm mentioning those, as I say, to give an idea of just how the rural world, the natural world, features in some of these kinds of diaries and personal testimonies. Given the intensity of such proximity to the ravaged natural world, to what extent were these experiences of wartime landscapes translated into post-war engagement with the rural and the countryside? There is certainly evidence of contemporaries musing on how various types of outdoor activities might mediate the strains of what was described as adjustment to the post-World War of new beginnings and general reconstruction. In 1920, for example, the noted climber G. Winthrop Young observed in his address to members of the mountaineering, climbing and rambling clubs of Great Britain how we are all scrutinising our former and long dormant activities and selecting only those for revival by our returning energies whose importance to our lives justifies the expenditure. A sense of mountain climbing's potential in alleviating mental distress was clear in his description of it as an interest which may be made incalculable to many lives besides our own during these years of rather shadowy stress. It's the finest, sanest tradition which we possess, and I think that idea of sanity compared, you know, with kind of what Nash is describing is quite an interesting one. And I think Winthrop Young had been a special war correspondent in France. He'd served over in France and Belgium. He'd been in command of the Friends Ambulance Unit on the Western Front, and he was in command of a British Ambulance Unit in Italy, so his papers are in the Imperial War Museum. This belief in the emotional equilibrium which might be obtained through physical engagement with nature is also discernible in some of the commemorative initiatives which took place after the war. Now, Keith Greaves has done a lot of work in respect of this. Greaves has focused on C.E. Montague, chief leader writer of the Manchester Guardian, another former soldier. He'd volunteered. He was getting on a bit, but he decided to volunteer. He was a keen hill walker as well. And Greaves describes him as a strong advocate that memorials in Lakeland to local volunteers who had died should have both practical utility and emotional appeal. And Montague promoted the National Trust's acquisition of Scafell Pike in 1919 as a memorial to men in the Lake District. And he also supported the presentation in 1923 to the National Trust of nearly 4,000 acres in the centre of the Lake District by the Fell and Rock Climbing Club as a memorial to its fallen members. And here we have it here. It was a memorial which, at least for some, connected lost comrades with an idea of the immutability of certain types of landscape, as was clear in the terms which the Yorkshire Ramblers Club Journal used to mark its inauguration. As the journal put it, monuments crumble and fall, but the everlasting hills stand fast and give inspiration to all who lift up their eyes to them until the end of time. There's also evidence, I think, during the war of how climbing and walking seems to have eased psychological adjustment tensions. G.H.B. Ward, the Sheffield walker, described how rambling in the moorland districts of northern England helped to pacify what he described as the wound-up batteries of jumping nerves. Rambling Handbooks declared it was patriotic to walk and to keep well, while Montague's descriptions of general areas in particular, upland areas in general, and the Lake District in particular, as a great delousing station, suggests their purifying appeal to those who had been at the front. I think walking, again connecting a little bit with what Grace was saying, walking, climbing, cycling, those sorts of activities are particularly notable for their capacity to control stress through a kinetic relationship with the landscape, one which allowed motion and physical exertion to restore a sense of control which, as far as former combatants were concerned, had not only been denied by battlefield conditions, but also by the way in which personal memories were subordinated to the public memory of official commemoration once the war ended. Because many contemporaries in the 1920s viewed shell shock through a pre-war lens which saw mental distress in men as unmanly and a sign of weakness. Soldiers who survived returned to a society in which masculinity continued to be defined by reticence and restrains emotions, a world in which it was unacceptable to broadcast nervous collapse or to express intense nervous feelings. And of course, these traditional assumptions were reinforced by public expectations of grieving after the war. Those public forms of commemoration were intended in part to expunge the pain of personal memories and contribute to a process of forgetting, which of course actually also made it very difficult for returning soldiers to articulate their own feelings about what they had experienced. Leeds points out, for example, how quickly the experience of the war was consciously forgotten in the 1920s as books and articles about it became unfashionable. It wasn't until the 1930s that ex-soldiers really started to tumble out their flood of wartime reminiscences. So the war, in many respects, in the 1920s was officially forgotten by not being talked about. But Fiona Reid has pointed out how forgetting the war was not remiss. It was also vital for psychological survival. Armistice Day attendance tended to decline in the mid-1920s and continued to do so until the late 1930s. And that emotional reticence obviously had immense implications for many families who returned home. Pat Jalland, who's done work in Australia after the First World War, has suggested that the scale of losses there helped shape a new model of suppressed, privatised grieving, which deeply constrained the next two generations. And that kind of generational difference is interesting, I think, because it's a reminder that rambling and cycling could also have therapeutic implications for some young people. I've done one woman, for example, recalled the enjoyment that her great aunt had experienced as a keen cyclist because it helped free her from a family atmosphere made tense by her brother-in-law's drunken, violent behaviour after he returned, much changed after the war. Medical personnel, on the whole, supported a repressive response to soldiers' mental distress. W.H.R. Rivers pioneered the use of Freudian talk therapy among shell-shocked soldiers, but very few soldiers actually had recourse to that kind of therapy. Those that did tended to be the officer class. And psychological approaches did, in any case, arouse considerable opposition from many medical professions. They were very unsympathetic to what they saw as cowardice or malingering, and they tended to stress the organic origins of such symptoms. You know, you can remedy that by rest, diet, and often sometimes electric shock treatment. Doctors such as Frederick Mott was a convinced eugenicist, and he thought that most war neuroses were due to inborn psychopathic tendency. He was a pioneer of research into shell shock. And he believed that a quiet and recuperative environment in which the mind could be diverted from dwelling in terrible memories was sufficient to enable servicemen to forget their traumatic experiences. Some have pointed out, of course, that actually did prevent him from having to listen to his patients' distressing histories by suggesting that they go off to the countryside. A rural system of treatment, you know, in institutional terms, is very important after the First World War. And the uncertainty of both doctors and civilians about the origins of shell shock helped reinforce a broader post-war belief in the therapeutic value of the rural. The government encouraged a rural system of treatment during the war and into the post-war period, when the restorative qualities of the countryside became a common sense solution to the war's psychological and physical legacies. Fiona Reid, for example, has described how commitment to a rural system of treatment became central to the government's plans for a system of post-war care. And survivors of gas tax, this was part of a kind of broader cultural sort of support for the idea of rural as a recuperative space. Survivors of gas attacks, for example, were urged to get out of London into the countryside, and others, terribly disfigured, took to a more rural life to avoid the daily encounters of city living. Where are we? The institutionalisation of rural remedies for post-war trauma shouldn't overshadow the ways, however, in which former soldiers themselves, who were not so severely afflicted, acted on their own behalf in managing adjustment to post-war society through engagement with the countryside. Most who suffered the after-effects of harrowing military experiences had little or no access to professional support and were forced to develop their own self-help measures. Contemporaries described the powerful appeal that rural peace and stillness had to soldiers whose senses had been flooded by primitive instincts during the war. Many sought a period of quietness, which Ben Shepherds has suggested could last from anything from a year to a lifetime. Shepherd gives several examples of rural recuperation, such as the nerve-tangled Ford Madox Ford, who found respite by hibernating in the Sussex countryside and committing his wartime experiences to paper. Joseph Milne is one of the rare working-class accounts of shell shock, published in 1918, in which he described his own form of self-therapy, which comprised gentle walking, warm baths, mental games and stooping exercises. If you look at Michael Roper, he gives several examples of ex-soldiers who moved to the country after the war, seeking its space and quiet, and similar examples occasionally appear in working class recollections from the period. There's a Salford-born Jack Preston wrote his own autobiography, and he was a keen cyclist in his youth, and he ended up pitched his tent outside a wooden bungalow in the countryside near Chester, which was occupied by a married couple, and the husband that he describes as having taken a terrible battering on the Somme during the First World War and had been invalided out through epilepsy, and they'd bought the bungalow with their meagre savings in order to end their days in the peace and tranquility of the countryside. Those sorts of purchases were not unusual. Many demobilised soldiers put their post-war gratuities towards a new life in the country to settle into a different, quieter, less stressful kind of living. I think the popularity of various kinds of camping in the 1920s may also be seen for some as a similar kind of restorative strategy. Camping under canvas recreated a small, restrictive, safe place, similar to that in some respects of the dugout, although, as I suggested earlier, these experiences were very varied and contradictory, and I'm not trying to generalise from that. These desires to engage with camping, walking, were shaped by desires for both solitariness and comradeship. For the psychological benefits of the outdoor movement also included those which stemmed from social interaction. There were a lot of DIY initiatives, makeshift plotland developments, which were so disliked by country preservationists that many kind of managed to kind of get to the countryside in those sorts of ways. Domesticated, there is a kind of emergence of a slightly, possibly a more sort of domesticated version of masculinity in the 1920s, and actually holidays under canvas or in caravans enabled men to experience environments in which they could enjoy a more relaxed form of masculinity. You know, where men had been never involved in cooking at home, they often had been as soldiers on the front, and that helped to sort of justify a different kind of engagement once they went out camping. It allowed a temporary blurring, if you like, of gender boundaries. One writer observed, the husband should give a hand with the domestic work of camp life, just as he had to do in the army. Army allusions flit in and out of kind of some of these recollections of some of this discussion of engagement with camping and walking in the 1920s, and they occasionally punctuate even the most anodyne article pools about the pleasures of open living. I've looked at one particular journal called Open Air. It was part of the same publishing stable as Country Life, so I wouldn't want to sort of over-exaggerate the meanings of what is in there. But there's an example of a city dweller called Sidney Howard, who describes his experiences as a weekend country dweller, having pitched his tent on a land which friends owned. His wife regularly left London on Saturday night, Saturday evening, for what he described as their cottage in the country. He followed late in the evening following a walk across the fields, I am down to it, as we used to say in the army, in the tent, lulled to slumber, free until late on Monday. And he described the luxury of finding himself in such roomy camping accommodation after sleeping 20 to a tent during the war. And those kinds of army allusions often kind of flit in and out, like I said, of these sorts of discussions of what it was like to pitch your tent in the countryside. Bell tents, you could kind of pick them up very cheaply in the 1920s. And one writer observed how doubtless it has its painful associations to many readers, but so now is the time to redeem its character. Believe me, it is a grand thing to wake up in the morning and realise that orderly offices are practically extinct. And when such a tent holds two or three companionable comrades, it is very different from the days when it contained a dozen discontented soldiers. The feelings evoked here of wartime experience are of discomfort rather than trauma. Nevertheless, I think they suggest in a very small way a certain self-consciousness and agency in how new meanings were being layered upon even the most mundane of wartime experiences. Both rambling and camping continued, as they had done before the First World War, to encompass many different meanings and many different identities. But the many different opportunities which outdoor pursuits provided for rest, recovery and rehabilitation made them a different source of psychological refreshment in a war-weary world. Writers in Open Air described recreational walking as a rare tonic, but also urged the mental benefit of moments of idleness on young men whose very active minds and sensitivities made them particularly attuned to the quiet potential of rural life. Again, you can find these before the First World War, but I think they're maybe being inflected in a slightly different way. Greater cultural acceptance of softer kinds of masculinity was clear in many contemporary literary works, where the emergence of a new kind of male literary protagonist, characterised by vulnerability rather than virility, testified to the more fragile forms of masculinity, which were identified with that dread disease of modern times, nerves in some form or another. And of course there was kind of lots of nerve tonics, lots of adverts about the whole issue of nerves in the 20s. Dorothy L. Sayles' fictional detective Peter Whimsey, who was himself a survivor of shell shock, is an interesting example of the flawed empathetic personalities who were depicted as turning to the countryside for relief and comfort in the 1920s. So, I have in fact finished, I'm just about to finish before 1 o'clock, which I'm pleased with. These examples are, of course, merely suggestive, extremely schematic, and connections with a rich pre-war engagement with nature and the countryside undoubtedly remained in the 1920s. I'm not trying to deny that at all. But what I have argued here is that the meanings of open air pursuits and the natural world were shaped in new ways as part of a process of personal and social meaning. As I suggested at the beginning, a substantial academic literature on the value of therapeutic landscapes has made scholars more sensitive to the physiological and psychological benefits of passively viewing natural environments, as well as to the role of physical exercise in restoring a sense of personal control. And we're back a little bit to Grace there, I think. Drawing on such literature, this paper's aim has been to encourage interest in how the emotional and psychological effects of the First World War helped shape individuals' engagement with the healthy open-air activities of the British outdoors after the cessation of hostilities and across the 1920s. What I'm arguing for is for greater attention to be paid to the process of psychological readjustment to post-war society, actually in the 1920s itself, and how this may have helped accentuate beliefs in the countryside's restorative potential. How soldiers adjusted to civilian life varied immensely and was greatly eased with the help of family, friends and employment. Yet even for individuals and families who seemed to settle to post-war conditions, coping could be a very solitary experience, especially in a period when the range of acceptable emotions for men was still narrow, when showing any kind of mental distress was unacceptable and getting on with life was a strong cultural expectation. Even those who had the symptoms of shell shock sought, as Reed suggests, to present themselves as ordinary recovering soldiers. They didn't want to set themselves apart. Rural revivalism and idealisation of the organic village community have often been seen as an aspect of a broader right-wing conservatism, an inward-looking, privatised, nostalgic, middle-class response to progress and modernity. What is suggested here is that responses to the countryside and the natural world in the 1920s had many personal meanings shaped by the war, which expressed a need for emotional healing set in the present rather than in the past. Links between emotions and health were articulated in novel ways after the war, when even oblique references, such as those I've kind of alluded to earlier on, suggest how contemporaries were attempting to process their experiences in new narratives of recuperation. Both men and women were recovering from painful mental anguish, and we need to know more about the strategies they used to make sense of the impossibility of homecoming by exploring these personal meanings through sources such as diaries, autobiographies, oral testimony and family histories. An extensive body of research has, over the course of the last 30 years, connected activities in the natural environment or open spaces with a reduction in stress. However, few studies, either now or in the past, have attempted to categorise the different types of language or phrases which could identify the personal value of the ramble, climb, or cycling expedition, or to reflect on these, on how these helped mediate the psychological effects of adjustment to peacetime society. The meanings of involvement in the outdoor movement and an engagement with the countryside were diverse, but such an attempt to map and understand them is part of a broader, as yet unwritten, history of how soldiers adjusted to civilian life after the war. It is also, potentially, a contribution to the under-researched history of civilian survivors and to a more nuanced appreciation of the relationship between emotional healing and the environment in the post-war period.
Questions, comments, observations? Yeah, Mike.
I love that.
Thank you.
There's an awful lot of thought goes into, you know, soldiers' experience after the war and when they have to, you know, psychologically and physically adjust to life. But I was wondering when you were talking there, because so much of it is about masculinity in men's voices. Mm. Yeah, just occasionally in the talk, there were hints of, you know, women too had to adjust to men who were coming home, yes, physically and mentally changed.
Yeah.
And some of your hints about, you know, the wife and the clan being the married couple in the bungalow.
Yeah.
Have you any sense of, you know, of any way in which the countryside might be used by women in those complex relationships to help, you know, reform, you know, adjust to a new situation?
I think that's a really interesting question. I've got no evidence of it, but I do think that, you know, there is a growth in the number of women who do start to take to the outdoor movement in the interwar years, but I suspect they're maybe younger. You know, there isn't so much the same, particularly in work. It's working class men who tend to go out and do the work in those activities. It's not so much the women, which is why I was really interested in that example that was given to me, actually, with an interview that I did recently, in which she was talking about her great aunt and just how she would escape from her family. I focus particularly on the outdoor movement, and, you know, because I'm interested in that idea of therapeutic landscapes. But I think there is a really interesting sort of evaluation of just how families responded and readjusted. And those memories live on in family histories, don't they? I certainly have them in my family history of, you know, my grandfather, who became very silent after he came back from the war. So, difficult. But I focused deliberately on the men because my topic was the war, but I think you're absolutely right. There is another story that is just as significant that needs to be explored. So thanks for that.
Mike?
Thanks very much. I'll just sort of fast forward you a bit to the Home Guard in the Second World War, which, because it's a specialism of mine, because in a way, that was a huge therapy for men of the 1914-18 war.
Yes.
I'm thinking in particular of the very start of the local defence volunteers, when it was almost comic the way that men leapt at the chance to do cycle patrols, patrols on horses, even patrols on boats on the Thames. So, the threat of German paratroopers was almost an excuse to get out the house and sort of get on your horse and have an enjoyable patrol.
And also to recreate the kind of comradeship that they may well, because comradeship and that kind of recreating though, because it, you know, it can be quite solitary. People are kind of wanting to work through difficulties that way. But you know, some of this is very much to do with trying to recreate that sense of solidarity with other men, I think. So. Yeah, and I think your suggestion that, you know, it is kind of a therapy for people who have served in the war, in the First World War, you know, a way of kind of maybe, you know, expiating, getting rid of some of those sort of terrible memories that obviously, you know, people retained right across the 20s and 30s. Because I think, you know, back to what Mike was saying, one of the reasons that I'm interested in this is that very difficulty that there was in, you know, being able to express those feelings. And actually it wasn't encouraged. You had to find other ways of expressing it. It wouldn't necessarily just be walking or climbing. There would be a range of different strategies that people, men, returners, became engaged in. So, yeah, that's interesting.
And just briefly, also a sense that they'd be useful again.
Yes, I think, yes, absolutely. I think there is a sense of, yes, making a contribution. You can't sign up, but yes, you are going to contribute in some way. I think you're absolutely right.
Thanks, Mark.
This is very much connected to this, but the idea of how much of this connects with military training is interesting. You know, the sort of the idea that, as you were saying, that training... perhaps, or you know, you looked at camping, and that was a framework that people were allowed to use.
Yes,
it was accepted, an accepted form of masculinity as well.
Yeah,
was using, going back to the things that perhaps you used in your training, but with a sort of a softer.
Yes, that's what I was trying to get at, that idea of trying to layer new meanings onto it. You know, it was something that, you know, you'd be used to the fleas and the rest of it, and cramped conditions, but you could actually experience that and maybe sort of help to recreate it, help reshape a different kind of a memory about it. I have a sense that every... Oh, sorry.
No. Rushing to... We're not in your 30s. Was there any distinction at any stage, or have you seen any, between the wild and the cultivated?
I've got particular interest in upland landscapes because I've worked on GHB Ward, and that sense of kind of losing yourself, you know, in the upper reaches of the Derbyshire, I'm calling it the Derbyshire moorlands. I think the domestic, but I mean that example that I gave of that, I thought that was a lovely example of somebody actually trying to recreate a garden in their trench. You know, it does speak of that there is a sort of domestic element in commemoration, of course, isn't there, after the war, as far as, you know, graves are concerned, where wildflowers and, you know, that is seen as a particularly English kind of expression and memorial. So I don't know. I mean, I think it would be very interesting to sort of track, you know, in diaries and in, you know, post-war recollections, some of the themes that I've raised here. Somebody recently said their diaries of a Liverpool cycling club, I'm not sure if it was an Anfield one, where they wrote diaries through the war, and they also sort of, there's correspondence after the war. Now, I don't know what that comprises, but it would be quite interesting to see if there are themes that you know, resonate a little bit with what I've described in this, or suggested in this.
Was there any ever, or have you seen any, appreciation of the bleakness of this war landscape? Is it all critical, or are there people who see this as...
I think people would find it quite difficult to sort of see. I've certainly kind of, during the war, GHB Ward writes about the upland areas of Kinder, and he actually describes them as looking very much like the trenches in Belgium, you know. But that's from somebody who's at home. He's not actually in one, you know. I think if you're in one, you'd have a rather different view of it. But he had a very kind of, through his walking, he suggests, there's a suggestion that he has a sense of connection with those, because he's not been able to, you know, he's too old to go to the front, but a sense of connection with people that he had walked with, you know, that comes quite strongly in some of the handbooks, I think.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Melanie. Time-wise, we're...